Riveting interview. Stephen Meyer, our special guest, signature in the cell. And we'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, do you address the origin of the universe before you even get into the intelligent design of life?
Well, I have an epilogue or an appendix that addresses the issue in a way, but there have been a number of great books that have been written about the origin of the universe way back at the very beginning. And as I mentioned, there's plenty of evidence of design in the fine-tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry as set from the beginning of the universe. So in the very fabric of the universe itself, in the structure of physical law, you find evidence of design. So that is not actually the focus of my book, but it comes into play in the discussion in a number of places. For one, trying to calculate the probabilities of, for example, life beginning by chance alone, or even the probability of a single functional protein arising by chance, you have to take into account the number of trials that you might have generated since the beginning of the universe. So you have to take into account the fact that the universe has a known age and that it is and that it's finite. And so that even the evaluation of the origin of life ends up depending on some of the things that are known from cosmology that weren't known, say, 100 years ago.
I was at a conference a couple months ago. And we were in a high-rise hotel, and I was kind of looking down at all these people coming into this conference center. And they, you know, they look so small when you're looking at them from above. They all look like little tiny ants. But each one of them, Stephen, I was thinking, each one of them was thinking of something that day, either the conference, what they're going to have for dinner, you know, their relationship, you know, their situation, their job. Every one of them, every one of those little ant-like people down there, they all were thinking about something. And I asked myself the most perplexing question that I could not come up with an answer. And maybe you can, maybe you can't. And that was, what the heck is life?
Yeah.
Just what is it?
It's a mystery, isn't it? Yeah. We've been on vacation this week with our kids at a place where there's little crabs and worms and things bubbling up out of the sand, and you know it. We all can recognize the difference between life and non-life, but it's been a very difficult thing to define that difference, even for scientists. You know, there's some mysterious element to it.
I was going home last night, and a fox ran across the freeway, and you know, it was smart enough not to get hit by me, and it was kind of limping anyway. But for a moment, it had this look, and it's almost as if we had eye contact. Me and my car and this fox standing on the freeway, kind of like gimping its way across the road. And there was this moment of, it sees me coming, doesn't want to get hit, and it just keeps going. You know, it seemed to be smart enough to know, get out of the way of this thing.
Yeah, and even much smaller creatures. I myself have a taste for arthropods, like crabs and lobsters and all those ancient arthropods.
You're telling us way too much about you. No,
yeah,
I'm kidding.
Yeah, exactly. my brother is a businessman. He always comes to our events and calls them Nerdoramas, you know. But anyway, we were just watching these crabs on the beach, you know, today, and they've got, you know, the eight legs that they coordinate beautifully. There must be a little crab brain in there, a central processing unit that's coordinating all those movements. When I have a colleague whose brother does program, who does kind of artificial intelligence on trying to simulate the way roaches run, and it is not an easy thing at all to create an artificial roach. Or so we know, as we begin to try to program what seemingly simple creatures can do, we realize, boy, there's a lot more involved in even the simplest motions and movements. And the crab has little eyes, and, you know, they're clearly reacting to you. So that's a little miniature machine in itself. And we step on them on the beach and hardly think anything of it. So we take a lot for granted when we talk about life and what it takes to make it work.
You're going to love this story. I have a friend of mine. She lives in Hawaii, and you know she loves to go on the beach and chase these little crabs that are scattering around. They come out a lot at night, and I guess they're these real tiny little things, and you know they kind of nip at your feet too. You know, if you're there with no shoes on. But you're right, they have a mission. whatever it is. And, you know, somebody who designed this, it must have been working overtime, because what's the purpose of all of them? I mean, the little crabs, the fish, the human being, the tiger, why did it do this?
Yeah, and so many of the systems upon which all of these creatures depend have a, you know, they're not just machines, but they have a mechanical, a discernibly mechanical element to it. The way the if you take apart the pincher of the crab, and you see the way the tendons are controlled by the muscles and the hinging that's at work. If you look at a swim bladder inside a fish, but for me, if you take it down even further to the most fundamental level of life, to the cellular level, that's where the most exquisite evidence of design is, because there you have machinery as well, you have circuitry, but you have this digital world that is directing the show, and it just connects us to our own high technology, our own information technology. Let me tell you, if I could, just a story about a colleague of mine. He's a architect level programmer at Microsoft. He retired for a time and came to work with us at the lab we started called the Biologic Institute. He was working with our molecular biologist to create an artificial genetic code, or what's called the gene expression system, simulating how the information in DNA directs the production of proteins. And he came into my office one day and he threw a book onto my table. It was called Design Patterns, and it's apparently a standard manual for design software engineers. And in it, there are all these what are called design patterns or design strategies that software engineers learn to perform various types of information processing functions as they're writing code. And there are strategies for error correction. There are strategies for hierarchical filing. There are strategies for distributive storage and retrieval of data sets. There's strategies for operating systems and various types of design logics that are necessary and functions that have to be performed by any information processing system. My colleague says to me, he says, when I see what's going on inside the information processing system in life, I get an eerie feeling that someone has figured all this out before us. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, inside the cell, you have all these same design patterns, these same design strategies, only they're being executed with an 8.0, 9.0, 10.0 elegance. They're the same basic logic, but the elegance of its execution is far beyond anything we've been able to do at this point. And that was a very memorable conversation for me, because this was a guy just coming straight out of the computer industry, worked on digital computers, elite level guy at Microsoft, and immediately what he perceived in life was the logic, the design logic that is embodied in all these different ways of processing information inside, not a computer, but inside a living cell.
First life, was it an amoeba, a paramecium? What was it?
Well, people can only speculate. We know that life began, the earliest evidence of single-celled organisms goes back perhaps as far as 3.85 billion years. There are some things called stromatolite fossils, the kind of blue-green algae that makes mats that can be preserved in the fossil record. And so we have those same blue-green algae or similar creatures today, so we can pretty much get an idea of what would have been involved in that first life. And we know that the first life must have therefore had the whole DNA protein gene expression system, that whole CAD-CAM thing I was talking about before, where the digital code is directing the production of the machinery. So it goes back a long ways, but it's fascinatingly complex right from the beginning. That's one of the key parts of this mystery, is that Darwin's whole strategy was to try to explain the complex forms that we have today, the complex living forms today, as a result of a gradual morphing from simpler and simpler and simpler forms going all the way back. The stunning discovery of the molecular biological revolution, starting with Watson and Crick and starting with a parallel track of discovery from scientists like Sanger and Kendrew, who are working on proteins. The stunning discovery was that the very simplest form of life isn't simple at all. It's complex on the order of an intricate factory and indeed a factory run by code. So if you want to, you know, account for the simple in terms of the complex in terms of the simple, you've got a big problem now, because the very simplest thing is complex on order of our most advanced information technology and manufacturing.
Now, the creation of life, if it was designed, was it done with the intent of, you know, I don't know how to say this, when the planets were formed and everything else, was it done based on evolution, intelligent design based on evolution, where we did evolve from, let's say, apes, or did we just pop up here somewhere?
Well, that's in a sense a separable question from the one I address in the book, but in the epilogue to my book, I make the point that the centrality of information, of digital code to the function of life, now can, I think, raises a pardonable curiosity about the sufficiency of the whole Darwinian story, not just the problem of getting to life in the beginning, but of the whole, you know, amoeba to man story of how you get from the simplest forms to all the complex forms today. It wasn't probably really an amoeba, but you know what I mean.
Right.
And so and here's the reason. Because when you need, it's this same principle that I taught my, you know, that actually my students would readily grasp and teach me. If you want to give your computer a new function, you need new code. If you want to build a new form of life from a pre-existing form, you need biological information. Why? Well, you have to have the protein. If you need a new organ or structure, that new structure is going to have some dedicated cell types. Those cell types required specific specialized proteins. How do you build the proteins? You need the DNA. Now, it turns out that since the 60s, late 60s, there's been a growing body of dissenting opinion about the power of the mutation selection mechanism, because at the very basic level, at the level of building, even at the level of building new proteins, you've got a fundamental problem in natural selection. Natural selection is Darwin's survival of the fittest principle, the idea of differential reproduction. It selects for functional advantage. But the smallest unit of functional advantage in life is a new protein. And it turns out that it's incredibly difficult by random mutations to generate new proteins. They're incredibly rare among all the space of possible ways of arranging amino acids. It's like looking for a tiny needle in a gigantic haystack the size of our galaxy. So it's the scientists refer to it as the combinatorial problem. So many possible ways of arranging amino acids, so many possible ways of arranging the characters in the DNA, and only a very small percentage of them are actually functional. So a random, undirected, blind search is much more likely to stumble on gibberish than it is on a functional sequence or a meaningful text. And we have the same problem in human language. If you start mutating computer code that's functional or a section of human language and expect that you're going to get something better or even equally meaningful, you're sadly mistaken. After just a few random changes, and it doesn't really matter whether you're talking about single point changes with a single letter or a block of text that you flip over, very quickly you're going to degrade function before you come to any new function. So there's a lot of doubt about, at a very fundamental level, whether natural selection acting on mutations can generate even the smallest increments of functional advantage, the new proteins and the structures that are made from them.
Stephen, have you tried to conclude just how and why then with all of this? And I know answers are very difficult for those questions, but have you come up with your own personal theory?
Well, in some ways, the case for intelligent design is a very personal theory for me, since I've got 25 years invested in constructing it. You know, but I think what you're asking is, who do I think the designing intelligence is, and what are the options there, and how do you think that through? there's basically two options. Either the intelligence that's responsible for life is imminent or within the cosmos, or the intelligence responsible of life is transcendent, a being beyond the cosmos, something more like God. There have been a number of scientists that have proposed the idea that life is so complex, so improbable, as the conditions to get it, for getting it going on life on Earth are, as Francis Crick put it, nearly miraculous. And as Crick himself ended up proposing, therefore there must have been some kind of intelligent being out of space who designed life and seeded it here on Earth. That's got two problems. It's interesting that a scientist of Crick's stature would come to the realization that some type of intelligence was necessary. But there are two problems with that way of thinking. First is, if the fundamental problem that has to be solved by undirected evolutionary processes is the origin of information in the first place, just putting that event out in space doesn't solve the problem. It just pushes the problem back one generation. And the other problem, which is actually a positive evidence for the other design hypothesis, the idea that the designing intelligence that's responsible for life is a transcendent form of intelligence, meaning an intelligence that is beyond the cosmos and responsible for the design of the cosmos itself. The other factor in all of this is that the universe itself is very finely tuned in its laws and constants of physics. The precise numerical values seem to be something some physicists call the setup job, that it's just right to allow for the possibility of life. My colleagues Jay Richards and Guillermo Gonzalez have talked about the fine-tuning that's allowed for there to be a life-friendly planet like Earth, and just how exquisitely improbable that is. So what I think is going on is that you're seeing evidence of design in the very fabric of the universe itself, and that's clearly not something that can be explained by the space alien design hypothesis, if you will. No being or creature within the universe can account for the design within the fabric of the universe as a whole. So if you take the evidence from biology and the evidence from cosmology and planetary science and you put it all together, it looks like you have evidence of a designing intelligence who transcends in its capacities the universe itself, but also acts within the history of the universe in the origin of life and other, perhaps other living forms. And that, to me, is much more consonant with a theistic understanding of design than, say, the space alien idea.
True. But you have to admit there's probably an abundance of life out there somewhere.
There may well be, and that was conventional wisdom for quite a while. And now there are some scientists questioning that, partly because of how special and improbable are the conditions that surround the life-friendly parameters that we have on Earth. The first book that broke new ground on this was by Peter Ward and his colleagues at the University of Washington, a book called Rare Earth. Peter's a great guy. He and I have debated intelligent design a number of times, but I'm very intrigued with his idea that Earth may be life-friendly planets may be much more rare than people ever thought. And then Jay Richards and Guillermo Gonzalez in their book Privileged Planet also picked up that theme to say, if we're thinking about how common life is in the universe, we can, of course, we have to take into account all the planets that are out there, but we also have to take into account how incredibly improbable are the conditions of there being a planet like ours. And if the improbability of a life-friendly planet dwarfs the number of planets available, we may be looking at a very rare Earth, or as they put it, a very privileged planet.
How about giving us a website, Stephen?
Oh, absolutely. For my book, it's signatureinthecell.com. And for the Institute, where you can find out more about not only my work, but Michael Behe's work or Jay and Guillermo's work, that would be Discovery Institute. And then the website there is discovery.org. So signatureinthecell.com or discovery.org.
Next hour, Stephen, we'll take phone calls with you, but for the next 30 minutes, what we'll have is what we call computer fast blast questions. So a lot of people who can't get through on the phone, and there are many, can try to get through on their computer. So that's what we'll do next, fast blast questions for Stephen Meyer on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Stephen Meyer. We'll take phone calls next hour with Stephen. When we come back, though, let's take some fast blast questions for him on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Stephen Meyer. And, of course, we'll take your fast blast questions now as well. Stephen, through all of this, was there a perplexing question for you that you haven't been able to get answered yet?
Well, I think maybe the one that we were talking about in the earlier segment, exactly how does mind influence matter? It's a profound mystery, and yet we know that mind does influence matter. We are ourselves conscious agents. We have direct introspective experience of the capacities of our minds, what our minds can do, and we can see the effects of our thought when we quote put our minds to something and affect the world around us. So that's a profound mystery. The question that got me started on this was you talked about the origin of the universe. I mentioned I went to a conference in 1985. I was a young scientist working in the oil industry as a geophysicist, and at a conference came to the town where I was working that was addressing the big questions, the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and this question of consciousness. And at that conference, I first learned about what I call the DNA enigma, and I was shocked, really, to find out that there was that evolutionary theory, evolutionary biology, had not provided an adequate explanation for the origin of the first life. I had been under the impression that the question had been all sewn up. And at this conference, there were some of the leading people in the world discussing this problem, all acknowledged that it was unsolved. And that's where I got hooked. It was on that question of the origin of information. And there was a scientist or two at that conference who had floated the idea that intuitively there was a connection between information and intelligence. Now, they mentioned, as an example, the SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Sure. Intelligence. And when scientists are looking for evidence of intelligence in space, what are they looking for? Well, they're looking for radio signals that could be information carriers. And so one of the scientists that first floated the idea that an intelligent cause played a role in the origin of the information inside DNA said, look, this is already an established principle within another realm of scientific inquiry. And people had not yet and still haven't found evidence of intelligence via SETI, but inside the cell, we had that very signature of intelligence in the DNA molecule, and that signature, again, is information.
Stephen, regardless of what we call the intelligent designer, to most of us, you can simply call it God.
That's what I call it, right? As I mentioned, there's two logical possibilities, but I think there are good reasons for favoring the theistic design hypothesis over the spaceman or alien
sure.
hypothesis.
But you are basically coming up with scientific evidence proving the existence of God.
Well, scientific evidence providing reasons for belief in the existence of God. Scientists typically don't prove things with absolute certainty. It's a limitation in the methods that scientists use. But you can provide very good reasons for believing in the existence of a designing intelligence, and further reasons for thinking that designing intelligence has the attributes of God rather than those of a creature within the cosmos, like an alien or something.
You know, if I want to get from point A to B in a car, I've got to plot it, drive it, know where I'm going, and get there. That takes thought. That takes design. The car's not going to get there on its own. You know, I'm not going to turn the engine on and it just happens. It's just not going to happen that way. I don't care how many times I start the car. I could start it a million times. It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. And what is required in any complex system is a very precise configuration of parts in order to produce a functional outcome. And one of the things I've noticed in this debate is that medical doctors, software designers, software programmers, mechanical and biomechanical engineers, electrical engineers, people that design things for a living or who work on systems that are obviously designed, like the human body, are very sensitive to the arguments that we're making and oftentimes much more receptive than academic biologists who have gotten in the mindset of hand-waving and saying, well, mutation did this, or when you actually understand how many constraints have to be satisfied to produce a given structure, whether you're talking about a protein or a cell type or a tissue or organ or a whole body plan or a molecular machine, people who design things immediately recognize the attributes of a design system in these things that we find inside life. Another quick story, another colleague I work with, he's a molecular biologist. He got a PhD from Caltech. He got turned on to intelligent design during his PhD years. He was doing a thesis that did a crossover between chemical engineering and molecular biology, and he encountered one of the regulatory systems that's at work inside the cell. It has this kind of properties that a thermostat does, where it's responding to different environmental conditions in different way. And he went to his supervisor and he said, "Hey, these regulatory systems inside the cell, these are obviously designed systems. I studied chemical engineering. What do you think?" And the supervisor apparently told him, he said, "Well, I know that, and you know that, but you can't say that." And so I think we should not underestimate the amount of suppressed dissent there is against this no design view of things that has come from modern neo-Darwinism.
All right, Debbie from Maryville, Tennessee. How does evolution and other theories explain where emotions of humans and animals come from?
They really don't. I mean, you have the same basic problem occurring in evolutionary theory. It's that natural selection, the supposed designer substitute, the thing that's supposedly creative, only works after the fact of successful random mutations or variations. And whether you're talking about something at the lowest level, like a protein, or something at the high level, like a human behavior, the functional advantage that supposedly ensues from a random variation is so incredibly improbable that the problem is that lots and lots and lots of things have to go right, and an incredibly improbable string of things have to go exactly right before natural selection can kick in and play any role at all in selecting that successful innovation. So we really are trying to get a handle on, that's not to say natural selection can do nothing at all. It does explain small, modest effects. But when you hear about, you know, a gene for religious belief or a gene for this behavior or that behavior, this is really, you know, we really don't know how something at that high level evolved, still less explaining human thought or consciousness.
John from Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Beyer, have you paid a price in terms of your career path in academia?
Well, a number of the people involved in intelligent design research have definitely paid a price. I've been reasonably fortunate in that, having started and directed the program that is the institutional home for research on intelligent design, I've been somewhat insulated from the pressures, although I had a personal experience that illustrates just how acute those pressures can be. In 2004, as you mentioned at the very top of the show, I submitted an article for publication to a peer-reviewed journal that was published by Smithsonian staff out of the Smithsonian Institution. The editor there received the paper and, as is customary, sent it out to three or four peer reviewers. The reports came back to me with recommendations. It was a blind peer review process. They came back to me with recommendations for some modifications and corrections. I made the changes. The paper was accepted at that point and published. Afterwards, an incredible controversy ensued within the Smithsonian. The lid came off, and because there really was no way to get at me, they decided to punish the editor. And the editor was Dr. Richard Sternberg, with two earned PhDs in biology, including one in evolutionary biology. They took away his office. They took away his keys. They took away his access to scientific samples. He was transferred out from underneath a friendly supervisor with whom he'd worked for years and over to a supervisor who was known to be hostile to him. His colleagues were interrogated by senior officials at the Smithsonian about his religious and political beliefs, and eventually he was demoted. An independent watchdog organization, the Office of Special Counsel, a federal agency, found in their investigation that of his case that he had that the Smithsonian had engaged in a disinformation campaign designed to to get him to resign voluntarily and to besmirch his reputation. So these, unfortunately, are not uncommon cases. Ben Stein, in his film Expelled, looked at four or five such cases as part of the documentary story that he told about.
These were professors who were censored, right?
Sometimes expelled outright, losing their positions. Sometimes they lost tenure, research grants. Some have lost, they've been censored. Their websites have been shut down. A lot of times what we heard before the article in 2004 was intelligent design isn't science because the advocates of intelligent design don't publish in peer-reviewed scientific journals. Then when my paper was published, they punished the editor and made it really clear that if you do publish in scientific journals, there's going to be a huge cost to pay. So the ID isn't science because it hasn't been published. And then there were people saying, well, it shouldn't have been published because it isn't science. And then because it's not science, we're justified in getting rid of this poor editor. So it's a very circular, exclusionary logic that has prevented the scientific community, or at least large segments of it, from investigating this really interesting question, the question of the DNA enigma. Where did the information necessary to get life going come from?
We have a forum out there called the Nighthawk Zone, and Beyond 92 wants to know if it's possible for life to continue to evolve until it transcends space-time. Now, that's kind of esoteric.
That is a bit esoteric. Life is evolving, but my perspective is that life evolves within limits, and that there's not an the mechanism of natural selection and random variation or random mutation can produce some real effects, antibiotic resistance, changes in the shape and structure of finch beaks, those sort of minor effects, but that it really has not been demonstrated to explain the origin of, for example, whole new body plans or new ways of designing organisms, such as arose in an event in the history of life called the Cambrian Explosion. That, by the way, was what my paper at the Smithsonian's at the journal that was published out of the Smithsonian was about. So I'm personally skeptical that natural selection can produce the major changes in the history of life, and therefore I'm also skeptical that it can go on indefinitely to produce a kind of transcendent form of new life or something like that.
Kenneth from Indiana, Pennsylvania. Why does life have to be based on carbon?
Well, carbon chains carbon forms chains, and if you want an information carrying molecule, or if you want proteins, you have to have some subtlety or some suppleness, and so you need a certain amount of chemical complexity to build the huge biomolecules that are responsible for the key information and information processing capacities that are necessary for any kind of self-replicating system, life included.
Jeremy from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Do you have any knowledge or have you done any research on sacred geometry? Fingerprints of the gods, proof that perhaps vibration is key to all of this.
No, I haven't done any work on that area.
All right. Next, Jamie from Bridgeport, Connecticut. What's your viewpoint on the possibility of cloning, uploading humans' memory data to a brain? What are we doing here? The mind can live on forever? With a question mark.
I had the occasion, when I was a younger scientist, to interview a computer scientist who was hoping that one day we could replace the brain with a silicon-based form of life and therefore achieve the goal of immortality. I'm personally skeptical about that. Cloning, obviously, it's been done in sheep. There are some ethical issues, I think, in trying to do that with humans that I think ought to give us pause. It's a big subject. We have a colleague at Discovery Institute, Wesley Smith, who's written extensively on cloning and all of the issues that arise, and I'd recommend his works for people that are interested in that topic.
Will anything break through where we will get some definitive answers here?
Well, I think, in a way, we've had a definitive answer staring us in the face
all the time
for 50 years. I mean, it's not, at some level, it's not that hard. If you found digital information, digital code in any other realm of experience, scratched in the cave wall or in a computer program that you realized was a computer program or in a hieroglyphic inscription or in an ancient scroll, and you would immediately conclude that that an intelligence had played a role. There is inside the cell a very rigorous sense, there is digital information. The four characters along the spine of the DNA molecule are not analogically like information. They function just like alphabetic characters in a written language or digital characters in a machine code. And so when you then consider that discovery in light of what we know about cause and effect, our uniform and repeated experience of the cause and effect relationships we see around us in the natural world, and you realize that only intelligence, only conscious activity is responsible for the origin of information, then it becomes possible to infer from the effect back to the cause. And that cause, again, is intelligence. It's not that hard. You apply standard forms of scientific reasoning to the discovery of the information-bearing properties of life, and you come to one unmistakable conclusion, and that's intelligent design.
You have to come to that conclusion.
There's no better explanation. We may find something later that forces us to revise our conclusion or modify it in some way, but I sketch out in the book the different approaches that scientists have taken. Some scientists have tried to explain the origin of information by chance, and that has been an abject failure. Some have tried to explain it by reference to what's called necessity or the laws of nature. But the laws of nature, by definition, describe repeating patterns of order, that is, repetition or mantras, not messages. And so that's a kind of a non-starter. It's a category error to think that a law of nature would produce the kind of aperiodic specificity that we see inside DNA. There isn't a law that generates a Shakespearean sonnet. There's not an algorithm that produces the text in a best-selling novel. That's a different kind of effect. That's information, not simple order. And I also look at attempts to invoke natural selection to explain the origin of information, and that's turned out to be a problem too. So the big problem there is you don't have life yet to get natural selection going. So to invoke natural selection before you have a living cell is a contradiction in terms, and yet some people have tried to do that to explain the origin of information. So I've looked at these broad categories of explanation and shown from the scientific literature why they have failed, and that leaves only one known cause of information. It's intelligence, and we have its distinctive effect right there in every living cell of every living organism. It's a fascinating discovery, and in one sense, one I think we've blinded ourselves to, and it's time to take the blinders off and recognize that we've been staring at definitive evidence of a very important conclusion for quite some time.
Has the intelligent designer made any mistakes out of this?
I think one of the parts of the research program of the intelligent design research community is to distinguish what we call the aboriginal design from subsequent decay. And we do see in life things that are not functioning as they were originally intended. Mutations are a great example.
How about disease?
Disease is another example. I have a colleague, Scott Minnick, a microbiologist at the University of Idaho, who works on virulence. And all these different diseases that are produced, things like the plague, for example. And it's an interesting discovery in this field that very oftentimes these diseases that are so undesirable from a human point of view have been produced because of mutations in the aboriginal, the original genomic instructions. There's a degradation of the original genomic program, and you can trace the maladaptive or outright nasty diseases to those changes which have taken place.
We're going to come back and take phone calls with you next, Stephen, on Coast to Coast AM.